precautions to help minimize the spread of coronavirus here, KRVS continues to operate its production and broadcast facilities so that you can still enjoy your favorite local programming. For updates from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the website is cdc.gov. For information from the Louisiana Department of Health about statewide public health actions and services, the website is ldh.la.gov.
Hello and welcome back to Bayou de Beltway. Today we're joined by former Governor Kathleen Blanco. Governor Blanco has been at Acadiana fixture for a number of years. She is a former state representative from this area. She was elected to the Public Service Commission. She was lieutenant governor, and then she served as governor from 2004 to 2008. Governor Blanco, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You were governor from 2004 to 2008. If you look back now, what are you proudest of? What do you feel like are your biggest accomplishments?
Well, Dr. Cross, I think the biggest thing that I am very proud of is making education Louisiana's number one priority while I was governor. I was able to bring funding up to peer levels for universities and colleges. I was able to bring teachers' salaries up to the Southern Regional Average, which is lower than the national average, and I had hoped that during my tenure I could actually get to the national average. But even the Southern Regional Average was something Louisiana had not seen in a quarter of a century, I think, or as long as we had been measuring that. The other thing that I am also very proud of is in the face of the awesome destruction of Hurricanes Katrina and Rita, I was able to put solid building blocks for recovery in place. And that meant that I had to get lots of money out of Washington, D.C. from a recalcitrant Congress and a reluctant president. And that's a huge story all by itself. But I was able to bring $29 billion into Louisiana for the recovery effort. And that is why we see so much recovery over the last 10 years.
$29 billion is a really, really large figure. Of course, that's had an amazing effect on our budget here with creating the sense that we maybe had more money than we really had because of federal largesse and so on.
Well, during my administration, we were keenly aware that there is always a recovery economy. But if you pay attention to that and you understand it, you can manage it. And not just the direct money going out to help the recovery effort, you know, to reestablish. We had damaged universities and public buildings. The Dome was a huge, you know, building that was destroyed, the convention center. We had insurance. We had lots of money from FEMA coming in for public buildings and all like that. But I guess one of the things that was unique was getting housing grants for individual families whose homes were destroyed. And the problem with the destruction was most of it was flooding, and that is not covered by homeowners insurance. So we had, between the two hurricanes, lost some 300,000 housing units. That's more than some states total housing values, you know. So it was a huge problem and one that that I was, you know, up to the challenge. I mean, it was frustrating to learn that some members of Congress didn't want to help us in the face of such a dire destruction. But you know, I would just worked my way around them. I went to the president when the Congress didn't want to do it. When the president didn't want to do it, I went back to the Congress, and the Congress changed leadership, and it started with Republicans and went to Democrats. And, you know, so it was just, you know, you had to kind of just read the tea leaves and go where you had your best shot. And that's what we did.
You had a funny line about that change of administration. I think you said something when it changed from a Democratic to a Republican to a Democratic administration, you felt like you'd died, gone to heaven, and come back as Haley Barbour.
Absolutely. Well, the Republicans were in control of Congress. They had the majority when the storm happened. And they were so sympathetic to Mississippi because one of the members of the Senate, Trent Lott, I guess, had a home totally wiped away off the Mississippi coast. So that they could understand. They could be, this was, you know, a very wealthy member whose big luxurious home got demolished. And so they could identify with that, and they wanted to help Mississippi a whole lot. But in Louisiana, you know, we had a lot of flooded properties. We also had a lot of homes wiped away, just totally wiped off the scene. But we didn't have a prominent fixture of Congress, you know, that could sympathize with who lost their primary home. So that way. So this flooding looked like less ominous than, say, having your house wiped away. And actually, Speaker Hastert told me that he thought Mississippi had taken the worst of the storm. And I said, why would you say that? And he said, well, because, you know, the houses only got flooded. They were still standing in the New Orleans area. And I said, have you ever been in a flooded house? I mean, even, you know, a foot, 18 inches, anything. I said, how about 8, 10 feet? I said, you would wish your house was wiped away. Because then you know what you have to do. When your house is just flooded and all your furniture and everything is sitting there and you got to muck the walls and you don't know, you know, I mean, it's just horrible. But, you know, that was the attitude. And it was a challenge. So anyway, but I just want you to know I succeeded and I got all the money we needed.
Well, that's fantastic. And those were interesting times, certainly. I think Katrina and the question of, you know, to what extent Congress should fund and be available for funding. I mean, it's been a point of contention ever since, you know, with Sandy coming along and with some of these other disasters. And I think Katrina really set the bounds for, you know, that dialogue that we continue to have about what's the role of the federal government, to what extent is the federal government implicated in all that.
I think when it's so extreme, you have to have a federal government come in to help make the world sensible.
You know, one of the things I wanted to ask you about was the dome down in New Orleans. And that was, I think, that may be something that you fought to bring the dome back. That was one of your
well,
projects.
You know, we were debating what to do with the dome. We didn't know if it was sound. We had to do engineering studies because water had surrounded the building and we didn't know if it had gotten destabilized or anything like that. So once we got through with the engineering studies, which were done very quickly, and learned that it was sound, that it was okay to go forward, I had to make a decision early on. The building really was damaged. Every square inch of it was either full of mold and mildew and just muck and nasty stuff. And looked at Tom Benson and the Saints, and the state had a contract, had contractual obligations to provide a place for the Saints to play, and that was the dome. So Tom Benson was making noises about leaving Louisiana, and for him it's a business, you know, and he wanted to stand his business back up. So San Antonio, you know, was a good place for comfort for him since he has businesses there. And he was really talking to them, and the mayor there really wanted him. And but we looked at the dome, and we looked at it with or without him. And could the dome make money without the Saints? And yes, it could. And so I decided 6 weeks after the storm that we would go ahead and refurbish the dome and put it back together. That was before I knew whether the Saints would come back. But I knew one thing. If we didn't have a place for them to play, they would not come back. If we had a place, there would be a chance that they might come back. So we started the process, and it was going to be a 2-year rebuild. When Paul Tagliabue called me, and he said, Governor, if you can get that building up in September of 2006 for the first regular game, he said, I will guarantee you the Saints will not leave New Orleans. He said, I think that would be the worst thing for the NFL's image, to leave one of its cities in its most dire times. And I said, took a deep breath, and I said, we'll work on it. We'll work at getting it up. We'll play in September. And, you know, and then all the people who, you know, were at the dome, the people on the commission and the managing team, you know, took a deep breath. And we actually made it happen in 9 months. And it was incredible to watch the process. I took a lot of criticism, you know, for making the dome a priority. But, you know, here we had this big iconic building that was just ripped. The ceiling, the roof was ripped. And the building was ruined, and it had housed and protected people and, you know, been a part of the history. And I thought, that is a symbol of despair, and we cannot let that building sit there like that. So it either had to come down or be fixed. And when we decided to fix it, I just knew it was going to be the symbol of victory. And that is what happened. And then all the criticism that came my way for having the wrong priorities and everything, in September of 2006, people were crying and thanking me and apologizing publicly. You know, just it was just they understood then what I had understood earlier.
Well, that's quite a story. Is there, so let's talk a little more generally. Is there something every governor coming in has to watch out for, or do challenges vary from administration to administration? I guess we would say, of course, not every governor walks into a Katrina. Thank goodness. What a terrible time. You know, we have a governor coming in right now, John Bel Edwards. What advice do you have for him, or is there something he should watch out for? Is there something from your experiences having been governor?
There will always be some unknown quantities, some unknown things that happen, and you're just going to have to deal with them as, you know, as best as you can. But I think every governor needs to pay close attention to the legislature and the state fisc, and that was the advice I gave Governor Jindal before he took office, you know, was to pay attention, because the legislature, I was a member of the legislature, so I understand the dynamic. They love to vote for tax breaks. They hate to vote for taxes. So the governor's responsibility is to protect the state fisc and let the legislature know, no, that's too severe of a cut. You know, I mean, maybe we can afford a small cut in taxes somewhere or another. But, you know, because of the no new tax philosophy and signing every tax break that the legislature passed, you know, John Bel Edwards is taking office in a very destabilized situation. I mean, there's a nearly $2 billion shortfall for next fiscal year, but the year we're in has about almost $800 million shortfall. For the year we're in. That is so hard to find in 6 months. I mean, it's going to be a very dramatic and emotional session for those members. They don't know what they're getting into. The new ones don't. And the old ones have never, ever voted for a tax either because of the last 8 years.
It seems almost unfair. You know, the fiscal, you think about the kind of house that you left in order for the incoming Governor Jindal in the last part of your term, right? But you think about the House, fiscal house as it is now for the incoming Governor Edwards, it seems like he's kind of getting a raw deal, because he's walking in, he's going to have to call a special session, and he's going to have to come up with $800 million to balance a budget that was actually passed and taken care of in the Jindal administration. So he's, you know, it really seems quite unfair.
It's pretty rough. The thing is, they don't really have to technically pass new taxes. They just have to remove some of the tax exemptions that were granted over the last 8 years. And they were big, big exemptions to mainly business of different kinds. And, you know, and it's going to be hard. It's just going to be hard to remove those exemptions to sort of right the ship.
Particularly in a mid-year situation.
Exactly.
I mean, that's going to be you know, I almost thought, like, I've been thinking, well, if John Bel Edwards does what's right and puts the budget back in shape where you can say, okay, we can reasonably, you know, maintain expenditures, that he'll probably be a one-term governor, because to do that, you're going to have to really change some of the fundamental things. I think you're going to make some enemies.
Well, and that's very true. It can happen. And the thing is that the governor is responsible for the state fisc, and this state government has suffered cut after cut after cut after cut. And, you know, the citizens do want a quality educational experience for their kids. They do support teachers getting decent pay. Teachers did not get raises for 6 years. No faculty raises for 6 years in universities and colleges and in high schools and elementary schools. You know, 6 years working for the same pay. That's what's been going on. While Louisiana was doing really well and booming, you know, through the oil and gas industry, that was the, you know, what the juxtaposition just did not make a lot of sense. Because here the economy was booming, but, you know, the state was being strained down. So, you know, you've got bare bones operations and you have legal obligations to fulfill certain mandates. And look, I mean, it's in everything everywhere. So he raided every little
coffer. You're talking
about
Jindal.
Jindal raided. Mm-hmm. He raided money. We had actually left a nearly $2 billion surplus. Plus, we had put money in certain little corners for big things, you know, like in economic development. I think we put some money, and you know, and they just spent it all down. Oh, they spent it so fast. I don't know what they got for it.
Well, you know, money goes pretty quickly when you're when you're talking about this state. But we're going to take a break right now. We're talking to Kathleen Blanco. When we come back, we're going to talk to the governor about some other issues.
You can skip the hassle of finding a buyer for that unwanted car. Just donate it to KRVS and turn it into a tax deduction. Or maybe you've got a truck or a boat or an RV you don't want anymore. Donate it to KRVS. It's very easy, and it helps to support KRVS. A toll-free number and link to the vehicle donation page is on our website, krvs.org, or simply call 877-KRVS-887.
Arriving at Radiolab, a full immersion curiosity joyride.
What?
Wow.
No.
Yes.
It was like,
your body jumps
and jumps. It's not smooth.
It's 11 million miles an hour.
Chup, chup, chup.
Splat. It was like,
what is wrong with you?
That's Radiolab, coming up Wednesday night at 9 on KRVS.
Welcome back to Bayou de Beltway. We are here talking with former Governor Kathleen Blanco. We were recently, just a moment ago, talking about the general administration and the budget issues. You've had 8 years to think about this next question. What's your view of the general administration, particularly in the areas of budget, taxes, and other things that you might think about? Now, of course, you're saying this as a Democrat, so we would expect you wouldn't be with Jindal on every particular issue, given he's a Republican. But just generally speaking, what do you think?
Well, I think that let's take party out of it for a minute. Every single governor of the past tried very hard to build Louisiana up, to build value in higher education. Governor Foster definitely invested in higher education, and he was the first to make that big of a statement. And I came behind him to continue his good work. And each of us have continued the good work of the governors of the past. Whether it didn't matter what the party was. And Governor Jindal had a different view, and he thought that government should be taken down, and he called education government. Now, there's government and there's education. Public education is what makes the state and the United States unique and special and different. And he devalued public education, public universities, public high schools, public elementary schools. He really devalued them. And we certainly have had a lot of problems in trying to get strong footing. But going back to Governor Foster's Republican administration, he started the accountability measures that began to bring Louisiana up. I continued his good work. I didn't want to rewrite the book. I saw what was going on. And so, you know, Governor Jindal thought he had to rewrite the whole story. But he called education government. And I think that became an era, you know, in his philosophy. And he wanted to have a lower budget. And so you start taking things down. You cannot devalue education because Louisiana needs that worse than anything else. And then because we have such poverty and undereducated people, you have to look at the healthcare situation. And you have to provide health care. We're in a country that is not going to let people die on the streets because they don't have money to pay for health care. They're going to show up at the hospitals. And the problem is that they were doing that. And we, the insured population, actually had higher premiums because our premiums were covering the cost of the hospital to take care of the uninsured. And so he had a skewed vision of what Louisiana's needs were and what our problems were and how to resolve them, and in my opinion. And it all began to unravel when the public began to understand that, and understand that a lot of his motivation was to give himself a presidential platform, which proved not to be effective.
Well, he certainly leaves office being more unpopular than just about any governor, I think, in Louisiana history.
He didn't have a storm to unravel his administration.
You have had a long elective career in a number of positions. When did you first start about – did you plan this out? Did you say back when you were – you spent, I think, 16 years at home at some point raising your six children – did you at that point say, you know, someday I'm going to run for the legislature, and then I'll be public service commissioner, and then I'll be lieutenant governor, and then by God, I'll be governor?
Actually, I'm one of those people who did not plan a life. I got out of college. I graduated from UL in education, business education. So I had a lot of business classes. And I began to teach at Brobridge High School, and I got pregnant. And in those years, when you got pregnant, they told you that when you began to show, you couldn't stay in the public school classrooms. And so, I got pregnant six times. That was so much confessing and quitting. I didn't go back. I just stayed home to raise my kids. It was so expensive to find child care for that many kids that it was just more economical for me to stay home after a certain point. And I raised my kids. And then I began to feel like I just needed to do something. We needed more money. My husband was an educator here at UL, and educators, you know, are famous for not making a whole lot of money. And because of our six kids, we had extra needs. And so I began to think about working, and it evolved. It just evolved. And I worked for the Census Bureau, and then I did reapportionment, and people came in and started telling me, you ought to draw yourself a district to run in. And I went, I'm not interested in running for government. And then Luc LeBlanc announced his retirement. And when I read it in the paper, and my husband was not home yet, we used to get an afternoon paper. He walked in and I said, I think I know what I'm going to do. And he said, what? I said, I'm going to run for the legislature. He said, you're going to do what? What? Do you even know what that entails? I said, no, but I'll find out, you know. And, you know, so that was kind of the beginning. My father had run for office two times and lost both times, so I hated politics. But for whatever reason, it just seemed like, you know, a logical thing to do for me at the time. I didn't know that I was going to have a very wealthy opponent, and that it was going to be, you know, a pretty serious race here in Lafayette. I did end up with a very small amount of money, beating three people, actually, and winning that legislative seat, and went on to get reelected to the legislature, and then ran the Public Service Commission seat just came open because the incumbent died. But I had been kicking it around a little bit. And when I got reelected to the legislature, I sat down, and Buddy Roma was the new governor. And I thought, oh, we're going to have a really refreshing experience. It was just the same old, same old, same old. And so I was. That's why I looked at the PSC. And then I was one of five instead of one of 105 on the floor of the House. There were only five women when I got elected and 100 men. And then through the years, we began to add women. into the legislature, but it's sort of ebbed and flowed on the numbers.
Yeah, right now we just elected a few more women, so we're no longer last in the nation in terms of number of women in the legislature. But we were up until this most recent election. Why are there so few women running for office? What made you different? How come there aren't more women who are sitting at home with six kids saying, darn it, I'm going to run for the legislature?
Well, it's a pretty big commitment. And I think that women believe that you have to have special qualifications to run for office, period. And the truth is that your life experiences or your qualifications. And there's no magical little formula. And it's how, you know, people are interested in how you present yourself and how you would represent them, how you would voice for them, and what your ideas are. And there's just great opportunities. I know that the elective office has gotten really, really rough. Rougher than ever. In each season, it seems to get a lot more intense. And a lot of women shy away from that kind of combat because now it's almost hand-to-hand combat. But, you know, we have women who are fighters out there. And I try to find those women in the speeches I make and inspire them. If we don't have women at the seat at the tables where decisions are made, having seats at those tables, then we're letting the men make all the rules that all of us agree to live by. And that's all government is. It's making the rules that all of us agree to live by. And then some days we wake up and we hate the rules that the men have made. And we say, well, we need to change those rules. And we have a lot of good men, so I'm not here to knock the men. And we have a lot of good men who are conscious of making rules that women like and are good living by. But this is just really different to have a woman there. And you can have women with different perspectives, too. Women don't all think alike. You have Republican women, Democrat women, independents, you know. It's like, just be there. And it's important.
When you were elected, we just got a couple of minutes left, but when you were elected as a Democrat. You've been a Democrat. Right now, there seem to be not that many Democrats. I think John Bel Edwards is the only statewide elected Democrat right now. So not only are there no women, but there seem to be very few Democrats at the statewide level. That when you were first elected in 2004, there were a number of Democrats at statewide. What happened? Were we just part of a wave? Or
well, I think that's cyclical. I think that Louisiana had a history of being a state of Democrats, and then lots of things happened on the national stage that caused people to abandon the Democratic Party. But I guarantee you that anybody who's in control will abuse that control, and it will switch. And over time, it will switch.
Well, certainly, without, you know, Jindal's faux pas and problems, I don't think a Democrat would have been elected this time around. If Jindal had created a position for him to run for president where people had really said, yeah, he did a solid job as governor of Louisiana, you know, very likely John Bel Edwards probably wouldn't have been elected.
And we also had a flawed Republican, a deeply flawed Republican in Vitter.
Yeah. Well, we have been enjoying talking to you. We could talk for much, much longer, but we've been visiting with Governor Kathleen Blanco, and thank you so much for coming on our program today.
Thank you, Dr. Cross.
Bayou de Beltway is copyrighted by KRVS for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without written consent of KRVS is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRVS, its officers, and members. Bayou to Beltway is copyrighted by KRVS for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without written consent of KRVS is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRVS, its officers, or members. To listen to a podcast of the interview we just heard, go to krvs.org.
We all make mistakes in life. Si tu avais manqué la dernière Franco Mix, c'est OK. Tu peux m'écouter this Thursday at 9 p.m. seulement sur KRVS 88.7 avec Drake Benoit LeBlanc. Et c'est formidable.
This is KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.